And now we come to something that I have to spend a lot more time on with you, or at least I've chosen to do so. Do you not know that wrongdoers will not inherit the kingdom of God? Don't be deceived. And then he lists the kind of wrongdoing. Most of them he's already used, but he uses two terms here that I have to spend time on with you. Fornicators, pornos, we've done that. Idolaters, he's already mentioned. Adulterers, that's new, we know what it is though. Boy prostitutes, practicing homosexuals, thieves, greedy, drunkards, revilers, robbers, none of these will inherit the kingdom of God. So for the first time in all Paul's letters, this is the fourth one we've looked at, Paul talks about behavior, sexual behavior, that is to do with homosexual behavior. It's the first time it's mentioned. Translated here, boy prostitutes or practicing homosexuals. Now, it's a big issue, and I'm going to dare to try to enter into it with you now as best I can, with all the information that I've been able to gather on the matter, and I want to just do it with you. The gospel is about human lives being transformed through the power of God's Spirit. That's what it's about, transforming all of our lives. Paul names some of the more obvious vices that resist grace, vices that corrupt the person and the community, and which without repentance will mean the loss of salvation. The list given here in chapter 6 duplicates the list he's already given in chapter 5, verse 10 to 11, with the addition of three. Adulterers, which I won't speak about because it's obvious in its meaning, and male prostitutes and sodomites. So, the Greek which he's writing in, male prostitutes, he says, malakoi is the Greek, sodomites, asenokoitai is the Greek that he uses, will not inherit the kingdom of God. So, I want to do three things with you. I want to take you through the Greek world of the day and opinions with regard to this that you find in the Stoic, in the moral writers of the pagan world. Then I want to take you through the Old Testament Jewish writing of the day, and then I'll take you through Paul, and as thoroughly as I'm able to do. You willing to journey with me on this thing? Because sometimes these texts are used as proof of positions in the modern world that they mightn't hold. So we've got, since Paul doesn't quite, he just mentions them, he doesn't say anything about them, he doesn't go into it, he doesn't explain it, so we better be careful to be confident in what is Paul actually writing against. How are these words used? What did he mean by them? And he may not mean what people mean today with regard to this. Or he may. Let's look at it. In the Greek-Roman world of the day, check this if you want to, but I'm confident in everything I'm telling you now. I've read as widely as I could on it anyhow. The male was judged superior intellectually and, importantly, with regard to physical beauty. Women weren't educated in the sense of schooled, very rarely, so you could say they weren't as a group. You do know this already. As soon as a girl came to that age where she was able to have children, she was married off by her father, into the advantage of the family, to a man who would be 10, 15 years older than her, who had a business or some kind of way of keeping, and she would become pregnant fairly quickly, and she would be a beautiful mother, and love would often come between them. I'm not saying anything about that, but I'm just trying to give you the system. So a woman wasn't a philosopher, wasn't able to do this, couldn't read, couldn't write. All of that would be the norm. Is that okay? So the men who do all the writing, by the way, just assumed that men were intelligent, learned, carried on the culture, were teachers, all of that, and women were, well, they might be lovely, they might even have children with them, and give them inheritance and all of that. and they were worth having if you wanted to get into a good family and have relations in a good family. But intellectually, they weren't up to it. I hope you realise I'm not giving my opinion here, but I'm just trying to give you the gist. But interestingly, when it comes to physical beauty, this is quite different from today's world. If you want to sell a car, you rarely have a male draped on it. Usually today, the woman's body is considered the thing, because again, the men run generally the advertising agencies. It's becoming less like that, thank God. But with all that world that you women know so well, the woman's beauty is pretty high profile. And by beauty, they mean a certain shaped body, usually half starved to death. But that's another matter. So whatever they think beauty is. But in their day, it wasn't. Beauty was the male body. And you look at the sculptures, not only, but very generally, they're male. And the male body was considered the perfect form. God knows why. But let me tell you. Secondly, in that pagan, not Jewish, now, the great Greco-Roman world, the world of Corinth, men were encouraged to have young males for sexual activity as well, to train them. Not saying the men were homosexual particularly, but a young male would be introduced into the sexual life by an older male to satisfy his and the young, and to train them in how to do it. So long as it was about education, it was about training in the gymnasium, where they were all naked, by the way, all men too, so they're in the, and etc., and initiated into adult life. Now, that was generally thought of as a good thing to do. So they didn't have any homophobia. You can read all the literature. I've read a lot of it, but I've also read people who've read a lot of it. And the literature of the ancient world has no homophobia in it. A lot of misogyny, a lot of putting down of women, a lot of thinking women are second class, a lot of comedy about a woman, for God's sake, you know, all that stupid male adolescent stuff, but there's no homophobia in that world. There were laws, not everywhere, but often, against sexual harassment. There were laws against male rape. There were laws against brothels for male prostitutes. And if males went out and sold themselves in the street, there were often laws against that. So I'm not saying the culture was in favour of gross, explicit, sexual male stuff, no. But if a man took into his keeping a younger man, pedophilia, pederasty, was okay. Not only okay, but encouraged. If it was long, there was also a respect and a care and a love and a encouragement of adulthood and all that. We can see all the dangers in it, because they're obvious, and I won't go into them, but we all know what the dangers are of power and age and all that. But in their world, it was considered generally okay, the Greco-Roman world. It's all through their literature. Coiffured, perfumed young men in the public squares, wandering around, showing off their sexuality, etc., was judged to be decadent by the moral theologians, what you call them, the ethic writers of the day, Roman and Greek ethics. And the word they generally used to talk about these soft, effeminate young boys, but in public, showing their wares, was malakoi. The word Paul uses in his text. It was judged to be against nature, kataphusin in the Greek, that's the expression they used, to have sex without the refining quality of education and without a genuine appreciation of beauty, which involved poetry and introducing the young man into history and the arts and sculpture and music and reading and all of that was part, and the physical strength and all that was all part of it. If you didn't have that and you just had sex with a young man, that was considered decadent behaviour, absolutely immoral behaviour, and no one wrote about it well. There's some of the dangers I've just put down for this unequal relationship, impermanent, occasion for abuse, humiliation. But their culture was bisexual. The Greek culture, And in general, they judged the advantages of this relationship between an older man and a young man to outweigh the dangers and the disadvantages of misogyny, but not of homophilia. Plato's view, however, is, it must be quoted, but it wasn't the norm. Plato says that man with man or woman with woman, this is against nature, kata physin, according to Plato. But most of the evidence that we've got is that most ethical writers, good people, or people expressing what the society were, didn't go along that line. They say nothing about two males living, and it was all male, by the way. I think there's only one writing, apart from Paul, where woman with woman was ever talked about. So it wasn't just because women's job was to have kids for the man. So the literature is all male. So far, all right? That's the situation into which Paul... That's what he's writing about. That's the world that they're writing about. What about the Bible? Is there anything in the Jewish world? Now we're moving into a different sphere altogether. The Jewish world has very little about it. And some of it is quite shocking, and you might as well know it, so that you don't go overboard by quoting Leviticus and all these people in this matter. There's the terrible story of Sodom. We get our word sodomy from it. Genesis chapter 19. I'll only read, you know the story of Sodom, I presume. Abraham's nephew goes and lives there, etc. But this, I'll just read you, you read it yourself if you care to later. Genesis chapter 19, verses 5 to 8, reads like this. So, Sodom is there, etc. They called out to Lot, "Where are the men who came to you tonight?" This is the crowd gathering outside Lot's house. "Bring them out to us so that we may know them." Pack rape, male rape, sexual rape, whatever. Lot went out to the door to the men and shut the door after him and said, "I beg you, my brothers, don't act so wickedly. Look, I have two daughters who have not known a man. Let me bring them out to you and do to them as you please, but don't hurt these men. They have come under the shelter of my roof." Hospitality was a big thing in that part of the world. So they must be hospitable, and these are men who've come as my guests. Don't touch them. Look, I've got two virgin daughters. You can have them if you like, but don't touch the men. If you don't find that horrific, I do, and I'm sure you do. That's the world we're talking about. That's the culture. That's the male, extraordinary male dominance that is going on. There's a worse story in the Bible. Well, I'm giving you the lot, by the way, here. There's nothing hidden. There's nothing else. The second story is the story of a Levite. It's in Judges chapter 19. It's even more horrific. This is the Bible we're reading. And you wonder why we weren't allowed to read it all as children. Judges chapter 19. Again, I'll read only from verse 22 to 26. It's about a Levite who had a concubine, that is, living with a woman, not married, but shacked up with a young woman that he had, okay? And they were enjoying themselves. They'd come up to this Gibeah, one of the towns. It was night time. The people wouldn't welcome them. So they were out in the square, and it says here, "While they were enjoying themselves, the men of the city," and they're not Jews, they're just whatever, "a perverse lot, surrounded the house and started pounding on the door," because an old man had taken them in when no one else would welcome them. "They said to the old man, the master of the house, 'Bring out the man,'" bring out the man, notice, "'who came into your house so that we may have intercourse with him.'" You'd think they'd want his prostitute. I mean, in our world, well, I mean, perhaps I'm just showing my heterosexual behaviour, but you'd think if they're going to be interested in anybody, it'd be the woman. But no, it's the man they want. "And the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, 'No, my brothers, don't act so wickedly. This man is my guest. Do not do this vile thing. Here are my virgin daughter and his concubine. Let them bring them out now. Ravish them Do whatever you want to them, but against this man, don't do such a vile thing. But the men wouldn't listen to him, so the man seized his concubine and put her out to them. The bloke, he said, he will take the concubine. They wantonly raped her, abused her all through the night till the morning, and as the dawn began to break, they let her go. As morning appeared, the woman came, fell down at the door of the man's house where the master was until it was light. She died. She was killed. But, thank God, the main thing was done. A guest, a male guest, was not harmed. So, you know, a worse evil wasn't committed. Are you following the mentality? Right. Does the Bible have anything to say about male behaviour like this? Well, both those stories are about it. There was a law against cult prostitution. You can read it in Deuteronomy 23:17-18, and it's against both. I'll better read it for you. Deuteronomy 23:17-18. None of the daughters of Israel shall be a temple prostitute. None of the sons of Israel shall be a temple prostitute. Okay? Both ways. You shall not bring the fee of a prostitute or the wages of a male prostitute into the house of the Lord your God in payment for any vow. Both of these are abhorrent to the Lord our God. The Jews were much more sexually moral than the surrounding world they lived in, male or female. Then come two texts. Leviticus 18:22 reads, "You shall not lie with a male as with a woman. It is an abomination." And the word used there, they don't use the word that Paul uses here, arsenokoitai, but they use arsen is a male, and koite comes from the word to lie. So they use the verb and the noun, which Paul has put together in the word he uses, which is actually, I don't know whether he invented it, but it's not used in the Bible at any rate. So the Greek uses both, and that's probably the origin of Paul's word from that text, because Paul would have known the text well. So that looks pretty absolute, but please be careful. It's only one line. There's no context for it. It doesn't go into, he says nothing about homosexual inclinations. In fact, there's no law against inclinations, as I hope you know. So a person who might be inclined that way sexually, that's not a sin at all. All they're talking about is behaviour. What did Leviticus mean by that behaviour? What behaviour did they have in mind? Did they have in mind two consenting adults living lovingly together somewhere? They probably mightn't have thought about it, I don't know. But we've got to be careful in applying these words to something as broad as that. Here's the second text, and these are the only two. This is the whole of the Old Testament literature on it. It's all we've got. Is Leviticus chapter 20, verse 13, says, "If a man lies with a male," and again, male is arsen, and koite is the verb, "if a man lies with a male as with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination, they should be put to death, their blood is upon them." Those two one-liners from the ancient book of Leviticus, with all their laws, are the information we've got from the Old Testament. There's no context, there's no discussion of the issues involved. It's clear, however, from Jewish writings at the time of Paul and earlier and later, that there was a strong disgust for male prostitution. There was also a disgust for it among Greek writers. So male prostitution was considered immoral, as well as a condemnation of pederasty. And you don't find that in the Greek and Roman ethical writers, normally. Plato has that one line that I gave you otherwise. So pederasty, that is an adult male with a young boy, as long as it was about education, literature and art, but it included sexual gratification, but the Jews were against it. Paul is probably making the same point. At least that, and from the evidence that we've got, that's probably what Paul was condemning, is male prostitution. He's condemning the male who flaunts his wares around the public square to invite people in. He's against that. I think he's also against, well, like all the Jews of his time, against this idea that was rampant in the Greek and Roman world of an adult male initiating a young boy into sexual life. through, even with all these lovely other intellectual things around it. The Jews saw that as morally abominable. So, what does Paul have anything more to say about it? Yes, he does, and I'll do that, and then I've done the issue as well as I can with you. What else does Paul say about it? And this again is the whole picture. 1 Timothy 1:10. Among those who behave in ways that are against sound teaching, that's the expression Paul uses, Paul includes fornicators, sodomites, and slave traders. That's how it's translated in the New Revised Version. The fornicators is pornoi, masculine. The primary meaning of that is male prostitutes. That's the word, probably the same as the malakoi. At any rate, it's male prostitutes that he's talking about. The arsenokoitai is the same word used in our text. Those who take advantage of the prostitutes, it could be. Those who go to the places of prostitution and for their own sexual gratification without any education, without anything at all, just use my boys for their pleasure. An andropodistia, which they translate slave traders, that word is used at the time in Hellenistic Greek for those who take slave boys into brothels for purposes of prostitution. So they bring them in, those slave boys, and use them. And that's the slave trading. It's not just trading in slaves, it's trading in young boy slaves for purposes of male prostitution, which still happens, unfortunately, in some parts of our world. So it still doesn't tell us a lot. It tells us that Paul is against these public, rampant behaviour that the Jews, when they looked at the Gentiles, saw all this behaviour and were against it. I hope you can see that so far nothing at all has been said about tender, thoughtful, loving, caring, gentle, private sexual relationship. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying the texts can't be used to talk about that, because that's not the ambience they're talking in. The last statement is the strongest one of Paul and needs careful looking at. Romans chapter 1, verse 25 to 27. Because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, God gave them up to degrading passions. Their women exchanged natural intercourse for unnatural, and in the same way also the men, giving up natural intercourse with women, were consumed with passion for one another. Men committed shameless acts with men and received in their own persons the due penalty for their error. That's the most broad statement of Paul in his letter to the Romans. I just point out to you, it's one of the very, very few texts we have from the ancient world that even talk about female homosexual behaviour, but it does talk about it. It's certainly concerned with male prostitution and pederasty or homophilia. What's the word I'm looking for? Pedophilia. And that's all that Paul ever says about this male-female sexual behaviour. I want to remind you, as I did earlier, even in the Thessalonians, Paul, when he comes to talk about moral behaviour or to list immoral behaviour, always starts with sexual moral behaviour. And that's pretty reasonable, because he knows, which we all know, that the way we live out our sexuality affects our love. That's why it's such a very important area for moral care, because we can abuse other people, we can transfer our love energy into these ways of behaving that are hurtful, irresponsible, and all of that. So he sees sexual morality as we all would, but he sees it as terrifically important, because it is about love. And he wants us to purify our love and find a deeper love and a fuller love and a more spiritual love, but involving the body, but
delicate and all of that. So everything Paul ever says about love, sensitivity, mutuality, being slaves, all that stuff, helps us see that Paul has a lot to tell us about moral behaviour. My conclusion, for what it's worth, after the full study of this matter that I've been able to do, is that Paul cannot be just dragged in to finish the discussion about homosexual behaviour. He can't be dragged in for that. It's not evident that Paul was even imagining homosexual people with a homosexual orientation expressing their love sexually in a sensitive way. I'm not saying he would have favoured it, and I'm not saying I favour it or anything. You know, that's not my point. My point is that if we're going to discuss this issue, which is a big issue, how a person who is homosexual, man or woman, how they express their sexuality, are they expected to be celibate for all their life when celibacy is such a rare gift and a gift that can only... Okay, a priest can find it hard, as you well know, but a priest is helped by the whole expectation of the community, by years of training to learn to try and be mature and loving and caring without sexual expression, and you'd all realise that can't be easy and requires a lot of training and care, and a lot of priests or other people don't become mature precisely because they're unable to be fulfilled humanly. So while celibacy is a beautiful gift, a rare enough gift and a difficult enough gift, how can you ask someone with none of that training or social protection or expectation to live a sexually celibate life if their sexuality is homosexual, not heterosexual, like the majority of us? And I don't pretend to understand it. I've tried, because I am heterosexual, and I don't think we can understand each other across this enormous thing. But there are beautiful, sensitive, homosexual men and women in our world. And when we come to look at how they best behave, how we help them love best, I personally think it's in a very complex thing, and I wouldn't be very strong to have an opinion because I know I don't understand it. But I have lived with it long enough to think I understand enough to know that I don't understand it. And I don't think reading Paul finishes the argument. And I don't think reading the Old Testament finishes it like God said. Because if you look at what God said, if you look at what these people were inspired to write, we have to be careful and say, what were they writing against? Because that's what they're saying. And as I've tried to go back into that world, I'm left clearly they're against gross manipulation and abuse in sexual matters. Clearly the Jewish and Jewish Christian writings are against what the bulk of, often very good people, by the way, good Greek and Roman moralists had too lax a view of all this and weren't aware of what was possible in love and what went on even in a sensitive relationship, though the culture generally thought it was quite okay, taken for granted to be all right. And often it may have been liberating, I wouldn't know. But clearly our writings from the Jewish perspective are against that. They say nothing about sexual orientation because the thought hadn't occurred to them. They were talking about behaviour, not orientation. So obviously even the church is very clear on that. But I draw a blank now on anything further to say about it.